Your kind and gracious Heavenly Father, I thank you for another day, another opportunity to have a conversation that will be meaningful to so many of us, Lord. People are hurting today, Lord. People are in need of wisdom and guidance, and their trust and faith needs to be shored up, Lord. And so I pray that throughout this conversation, you will bless us, give us insight, and just that sense of your ever presence in our life. Thank you for our guest today. Thank you for those who are listening and watching. May there be a blessing on their lives today too. In Jesus' name, amen. Good morning and welcome to What's the Message. It's me, Carmela Monk Crawford, your host. I'm the editor of Message Magazine, which, as we all understand, is the longest running, continuously published Black and Christian magazine in the country, I believe on the continent, as well as possibly the world. We're still checking on it. I'm not sure. But God is so good to us. And we believe that he has preserved this gift of Message Magazine because the Black experience, the word through the Black experience by and through and to Black people has been very important, and it is instructive, and it is enriching and uplifting is what I should say. But we believe that God has something to say through this authentically Black publication, and we're here for it every week. We're here because we believe in the three R's. And for us today, we say relationship, redemption, and readiness. That's what we do here at Message Magazine. God is so good to us. And we are joined today by two guests. I'm going to bring on one right now. You know her, Donna Green Goodman, who is our dear friend. I'm just going to go ahead and reintroduce her for people who may not know or may not remember that Donna Green Goodman has written for Message Magazine for two decades now, at least. And she writes from Huntsville, Alabama, where she and her husband operate the Lifestyle Therapeutics, a lifestyle for better health center. She is a health educator who is a 25-year breast cancer survivor, and she's been a college professor as well as a national ambassador for the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Circle, a promise campaign. You know, Donna, that's hard to say. Anyway, and she is author of Something to Shout About, Cooking Up Good Health, Still Cooking Up Good Health, and the executive producer of her own cooking show, Cooking Up Good Health, which aired on Hope TV. And you can catch Donna on her own YouTube channel when you get the chance. Donna, we'll give you a chance to talk about it. But good morning, my dear friend. How are you?
I'm so glad to be here. How are you?
Oh, it's always good to talk to you, Donna. You know, our hearts, you and I just talked a few days ago, and our hearts are in a sober place, because as many people who may be watching or listening right now, one of the key leaders, and as far as Message is concerned, he was a member of our board of our executive committee, as well as our contributing editors board, Elder Henry Fordham and his dear wife, Sharon, that passed away this week. And this has been such a shock for the people in and around Message. If you're not part of, you know, this, that Message, what should I say?
Circle.
Yeah, if you're not part of that, you may not know him. You've got to know that he was such an inspiration, a man full of wisdom, and we loved him so. Donna,
you know? It's been tough. Every morning I'm waking up reminiscing, looking at pictures, crying, praying, yeah. And then being challenged because of the beautiful example of leadership and love that he and his wife gave us. I'm challenged to make sure that I'm walking fully in the gift that God has given me that I'm responsible for, because one thing this has taught us is we are not promised tomorrow. And as we recognize him and his wife, Sherry, we can say with confidence that they laid it all out on the table. They did everything that they were supposed to. And I've been challenged to make sure that that is the place that I am in, because tomorrow is not promised.
Right. And we've been challenged to embrace, like you said, what God has given us in the Fordhams. The family is very extensive, and we send our love to all of them. Our prayers are constantly with them right now during this time, to lose both mom and dad and to be here remaining. And Donna, unfortunately, you know what that's like. And so we are just so appreciative for the life and the example that they left for us, and challenged, you know, as a minister, they have plenty of clips of him on video, you know, just saying to people, keep holding on, keep trusting, no matter what happens. And so now in a time like this, you're able to come back and listen to that wisdom, and it challenges you because it comes straight from him, and say, hey, you know, no matter what happens, I'm going to tell you something, and I hope this hits okay. When, you know, Elder Fordham, one time we were in a meeting, because even though he had been my pastor before, he, now that I work at Message, you know, we would sometimes sit at the same table together in leadership circles. And one thing that he said to me, because he knew my father, I'm telling you, this goes way back. Elder Fordham says, you know, I remember your father, and I remember him telling us a story that was, you know, sort of a irreverent parable, if you could say. You know, and so we were sitting at dinner at lunch, and Elder Fordham told me this story, which I thought was so funny, but it was instructive. I don't know. Should I tell the story? I don't know. He said, so he's telling the story about little barnyard mouse, right? Mm-hmm. And he said, this is a story that my dad told him. And so now he was passing it on to me, right? So he told the story of a barnyard mouse on a cold winter day who was scurrying across the farmyard. And he's all out there in the world by himself. He's hungry, he's cold, when unfortunately the cow patty hit him right in the midst of his run. And so he is inundated by this calamitous event in that moment. This is the story that he's telling me that my dad taught him. And so he said, you know, at first it's like, oh my goodness, this is terrible. But then he realized, you know, I'm not cold anymore. I'm not cold anymore. And so then, you know, he's getting kind of comfortable, when all of a sudden the barnyard cat comes and snatches him up by the tail and eats him up. And so he looks at me and my eyes are wide. I'm like, why are you telling me this story? And I'm thinking to myself, why would my dad tell him
that story?
And so what he said to me was, so your dad said the moral of the story was, not everyone who dumps on you is your enemy. And not everyone who pulls you out
is your friend.
Is your friend. Oh, Lord, that's just, you know, that's the circle of our friendship, in the circle of the relationship, that he would share something like this. Because I lost my dad, you know, more than 27 years ago. And just, you know, to tell me that story. And, you know, Elder Fordham was just the kind of person who would come alongside you and encourage you. I don't care who you are. So Donna, we are challenged to keep going on in life and keep living the life the best that we can.
Absolutely. And
keep doing what we can do, because like you said, this day is our gift, and what is the present, right?
It's so interesting, Donna, you share that story. I didn't not tell you this, but I guess about 5 or 6 years ago, I get an email from Sherry. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, let me respond. And the email was, Donna, I really need to get in touch with you. And I'm reading it in her voice, you know, in my head. And we connected, and she was talking about the fact that she sees the recipes in Message magazine. And she just kept remembering when we were all in college. She and my parents were married students in college.
Oh,
and
wow.
Her husband, Butch, was in my father's class. So yeah. I'm 10, 11 years old at the time, and you're remembering things from a child's perspective. Mm-hmm. But the reason that she was calling me was she remembered my mom teaching her how to make homemade gluten. And she couldn't remember all the details and the recipes and everything. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I remember that too. On Sunday mornings, a lot of the women were not in school, the husbands were. So the mothers got a chance to get away from the families on Sunday morning. And my mom would be one who would gather the women together.
Wow.
They would sometimes do Bible studies, but what they really enjoyed was learning how to cook more healthfully. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that she remembered, how to make gluten, not from the instant gluten that people are using now, the seitan, but this is old school where you put the water in the flour and wash it out and all that, and all of the delicious recipes that you could make out of it. And so I was able to share that with her. And I kept thinking about that over the week as I prepared to talk to you, because she connected that experience to what I'm doing with Message Magazine and how Message Magazine is still an amazing resource, not just for recipes, but for other information that can be beneficial to the body of Christ and those who are trying to reach others with the story of Christ. And, and that's a warm, precious memory. We must have connected like three or four more times, making sure it was right. Well, what do I put in this? And the memories that you create stay with you forever. And I just loved her. I just loved her so much.
Oh, we love them, man. We are tasked to keep going and keep doing the best so that we can see them again. And but you know, my question, Donna, obviously God has blessed you. You got on your pink today. Talk to us, for those to remind where God has brought you from and what you're doing.
In 96, I was living in Atlanta and was diagnosed with invasive aggressive metastatic breast cancer and told that I only had 2 to 5 years to live. I was recommended to do, because it was advanced, I was stage 3, 6 of 17 lymph nodes positive. And this is 25 years ago, so they didn't have the kinds of resources that they have now. They said that I needed to do chemotherapy, a stem cell transplant, more chemotherapy, radiation, and tamoxifen. And because I was working in Atlanta, and I was affiliated with Crawford Long Emory Hospital as this place where I got my care, I had worked at Morehouse School of Medicine in a cancer prevention project, and then was working at the Office of Nutrition, teaching people how to use nutrition as part of a healthy lifestyle. I had a bunch of questions. My undergrad is at Oakwood University, which is the only vegetarian HBCU in the country. And then I did my graduate work at Loma Linda University, which is home of the Adventist Health Study. So that kind of shaped my perspective about not just cancer, but disease generally. And so I began to look for other options because I was experiencing cognitive dissonance. How could I be getting this when I've been practicing what I've been telling other people about eating healthy and exercising and not being stressed and all that sort of stuff? And the fact that your choices can change your body's system as it responds to the attacks from cancer and diabetes and so many other things. And so every doctor that I talk to is like, well, I'm really sorry to be the bearer of good bad news, but it's not going to get any better. You need to do this. So then I asked one of the oncologists, what is the survival rate of the people who do all this treatment that you're talking about? The stem cell transplant was $150,000. There was no insurance to cover it at the time. So in addition to having breast cancer, I would have been in debt $150,000 when I came out of it. Yeah. So they said that women don't live longer. They don't live longer if they do the treatment. What? And so I'm thinking, And so I'm thinking, all right, so then I need to find some other options. And that's when I went back in my closet and I'm talking to the creator about what I need to do from here. And I was directed to the spirituality of my health and my relationship with Christ, as well as the lifestyle component of healthy living. And that took me back to the principles that I learned at Loma Linda. So I found this facility in North Georgia, Wildwood Lifestyle Center and Hospital, which has been in existence since 45, and they're teaching people how to do all this stuff. And I decided to go there to literally build my body's immune system, because I knew we're exposed to cancer every day. Some of us get it, some of us don't. When there's a break in the immune system, then the protection is not as strong. And so I'm trying to figure out, why don't I build immunity back up before I do this treatment? Went to Wildwood, stayed there 10 days, and I was on a totally plant-based diet. I had been lacto-ovo vegetarian for the first 37 years of my life, and now I was totally plant-based. I was taught the role of stress in disease, and that was really a surprise to me because I had focused more on the food part of it. I was also taught and led through exercise ritual that helped. And then instead of doing chemotherapy and all that, which is part of traditional medicine, they utilized some treatments that helped to spark the body's immune system. And so I did hydrotherapy, and there were some herbs that were prescribed that are known to help with balancing hormones, because hormone often feeds breast cancer. And I stayed for 10 days, and I came home, and I decided that I was not going to do the chemo or the stem cell or the tamoxifen. I would do part of the radiation. I did that. And probably 6 months later, went to see how things were going. The doctor said it was worse. And then I'm like, now it's time to walk by faith, because not only did I discover improvement in the breast cancer symptoms, because she was saying that it wasn't improved, but my weight was better. My migraines were gone. My stress, everything was just getting better. So I worked for 3 more months doing what I knew. And then when I went back to her the last time, I asked, could I see my records? And when I looked at my records, I saw that in December, she had not told me what was in my records. Wow. I had improved in 6 months, and I had improved even more in the following 3 months. So I asked her what that was, and she said she couldn't say it was cure because I didn't do what they asked me to do. If I had done their treatment, then they would say that it was cure, but they couldn't say that because I did not do the treatment. And she didn't want me going around telling people that if they ate better and exercised and mended relationships and had a faith and a power outside of themselves and drank plenty of water, that they could improve their health. And so I knew then, there was a bigger picture going on. And I determined then that as long as God gave me breath, I would do what I'm doing and sharing this information and showing people how to make the changes and encouraging them along the way. And now 25 years later, there's a whole cadre of lifestyle medicine practitioners that understand through peer-reviewed journals that, you know what? Eating a high fiber diet helps. You know what? Getting your sleep. Even as we're talking about COVID these days, there are plenty of articles that are suggesting if you make healthier choices, your body responds differently to what affects you. And so that's what I've been doing for these last 25 years. And I'm just so grateful to God for the opportunity to do it.
We are so grateful to God for what he is doing. You know, I love when you tell, and you know, you all may not know, but we go around sometimes and we go to different places and people listen to Donna's story and they are stunned at what God is doing. And the thing is, you know, Donna, what I like about you is that you don't come across as, you know, forget all of that, just walk by faith, which I believe in faith. I also believe that God is giving us information that we can use, that we can share with other people, and it will change your life. And right now with the message, you are giving us stories of people who are doing the same thing.
Right. And the Bible says that your faith is made perfect by works. Faith without works is dead. And a lot of us like to focus on the faith part, but in the Bible, in several instances, the woman who they dragged into the temple, who they set up in adultery, as Jesus watched that whole situation, he said, I don't condemn you, but he also said, go and sin no more. And so making the connection between our choices and our outcomes is very important. And if you are a person of faith, and we are discovering scientifically that there are some benefits when a person believes in a higher power. So when you believe in that higher power and you can ask God to do some things for you, he promises that he will do it. When the lepers walked up to him, you read all through the gospels, anybody who asked for healing got the healing. So God doesn't have a problem with that. But what we have to understand is that I believe there are 3 ways that things can happen. Sometimes it's because of something that someone else did in the past. the tendency to alcohol because your parents are alcoholics. Sometimes it's something that I did. I was a consumer of caffeine. And we know that that changes breast tissue. So that was something that I did. And then sometimes it's because God wants to be glorified. The blind man in the Bible, he didn't do any of this, or the crippled man, he didn't do this. This was allowed because I was coming today to heal him in your presence. And so when you identify what connects your choices to your outcome, was it you, was it mom and daddy, or is God trying to glorify you? Then you know the choices that you have to make. And I had to get busy making choices because I'd asked him for the healing. I did the type of treatment that I was comfortable with. And then I knew now that being overweight impacted me getting it, not exercising as much. I exercised, but I was inside of a gym all the time and I needed to be outside in the fresh air and sunlight. And that wasn't my favorite thing. I enjoyed laying out in the sun. And we understand now that the sun with the vitamin D helps to build body immunity. And when it comes to cancer, it literally shrinks tumors. The fact that I would stay up at night and watch TV in Atlanta. I know our next guest understands you don't get the summary of the day's activities till 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And then when that goes off, you're watching movies and stuff. And that's what I was doing, and eating chips and drinking soda. You can't do that and live and be healthy. And so I had to go to bed at night, and the science is behind it. And so what I'm thinking is the Creator God knew what he was doing when he made us a certain way. And he asked the people to believe him. That's what we find out with Adam and Eve in Genesis. But here we are in 2021, where there's a lot of question about stuff. And he has provided the science which confirms what he said. And to me, that is just, that's a miracle. And so when you make those connections, especially to people who have lost hope, and can say to them that God knows what he's doing and he can heal you. And then this is how you maintain your healing. It's just a win-win situation.
A win-win situation. Donna, what is fun is that, you know, we get to, we put these plant-powered recipes in message. And that's why I wanted to bring you on, because I want to reintroduce to people who are watching and listening, and just a reminder or refresher why we do this. Because your health, when you don't have your health, you don't have anything. And when you don't have your health, it obviously has an impact on your spiritual perception and your, what's the word that I'm looking for? Just your sense of well-being and faith, I believe. Now, what is interesting is that we've been on this plant-based journey for a while now. And those who know me and knew Claudia, we always used to joke about how Claudia was, you know, she was still like, I'm eating my chicken or whatever. But now we've all gone on this journey with you, my family included. When we watched your 25th anniversary special about a month ago, 3 weeks ago now, when you were celebrating, you had these experts on as you celebrated 25 years cancer-free. I went back home and I said, okay, look, now, okay, come on. We got to get rid of this cheese. You all come with me. We got to, you know, the Chick-fil-A. I know Chick-fil-A is good. I mean, let's just try it. Okay. And so we've been trying it. And so I had a major fail, Donna, because what you always say is, make the stuff that people like, just, you know, change it out. And I asked you about my macaroni and cheese.
Yes. It didn't go well.
No, it did not go well. You know, first of all, I tried my cheese. So my mother-in-law is visiting us. All right. And so the two of us tried two different ones. Now mine tasted okay. It looked a hot mess because the cheese that I was using did not melt. Okay. And so not only did I have little shreds, I had little squares, and everything was very distinct and you could tell. And so it was embarrassing. Okay. Now my mom's recipe was interesting because what she did was made like a macaroni and cheese sauce.
Yes.
So what she did was took a carrot, an onion, a potato.
Yes.
To make and boil and made the sauce. Now it looked like macaroni and cheese, but it didn't taste like it.
Okay. So part of what I get to do since my diagnosis and my lifestyle change is meet people like like what you're describing. So what could have happened to the recipe? For your mother-in-law's recipe, she might not have had the seasonings in there because potato and carrot and onion don't taste like milk and macaroni and cheese. So then I would suggest some things that she could have added to that: onion powder, garlic powder, a bouillon if she wanted to, some nutritional yeast flakes, some paprika, some smoked paprika, the things that you traditionally would put, and some salt. And then for yours, I want to ask you, did you cover the mac and cheese when you baked it?
No.
That's the answer. You can be successful now. One of the things that we have got to understand as people are making transitions, and some of us just make a cold turkey like I did, and others are like, okay, I'm going to just do meatless Monday, is that the food that we're used to eating, whether it is animal products or processed food, has a whole different chemistry behind it. Mm-hmm. And when we were making mac and cheese, vegan mac and cheese 25 years ago, when my mom and I came up with this recipe, the cheese back then didn't melt at all, but they've created some other cheeses. And as we begin to experiment with those cheeses, what we discovered is the plant-based cheese has a totally different melting point than animal cheese does. And so if you want plant-based cheese to melt, when you're baking it, you have to cover the dish so that the heat steams it. And then when you open and take the top off of it, if you want those little southern brown spots that, you know, you eat down here, when you have mac and cheese, you broil it a little bit. And then when you dip your fork down in there and lift it up, you get the same texture and look and taste as you would if you had made traditional macaroni and cheese.
I am so embarrassed that that's the problem.
That's it. That's all it is. But if you don't know those little things, and a lot of times I will tell people, if you're following recipes that are in my books or in Message Magazine, do what it says the first time. I had one lady who made the pound cake. Donna, the cake was horrible. Tell me what you did. And she walked through it. And then I put it in the KitchenAid. I said, is KitchenAid in the recipe? She said, no. I said, you don't have to whip this cake. You just stir it like you're making cornbread. So little tips like that make the difference. You can make this again, Carmela. You can make this again.
But that leads me to my last question.
Yes.
And I'm going to ask you where, you know, so that people know, so they can follow you and all that sort of thing. But my last question then is, because I saw this Roland Martin live, his whole show was about, should we be eating fake meat?
Right.
And so that's the question, the fake, you know, the analog, the so-called meats, the cheeses, maybe we should just be leaving it alone and let go of that whole taste of whatever that is.
Well, I think it's more texture than taste, because you can put the taste in the mac and cheese your mom was making and you'd have the taste there. The thing with meat analogs, historically within the belief system of Seventh-day Adventism, it's always been there. And in Asian cultures, it's always been there. Mm-hmm. The processing, the serious processing of it became more involved as it became more marketable and you can make money off of it. Mm-hmm. And so my quick answer would be to you, you can't beat whole food plant-based. You can't. You cannot beat eating an apple or a mango or some good collard greens. You can't beat it. But for people who are in the habit of eating meat and meat products, to have a substitute for them as they transition is good. And then when I hear people say you shouldn't eat the fake meats, well, what is fake meat really? Because I can make an oat burger out of oats, or a pecan patty out of pecans, or a millet burger out of millet, which is still whole grain, and it's on the plate with gravy on it or barbecue sauce or curry to imitate what another person has made. Mm-hmm. I think that the highly processed meat substitutes can be challenging. However, the highly processed ones still do not have cholesterol or animal saturated fat in them, which are what is the risk factor for disease. And so my recommendation to people is, if you're going to eat those products, read the label. If it has too much sodium or too much fat, move over in the aisle and see if there's one that doesn't have as much stuff. And get in the habit of learning how to make your own. Subscribe to Message Magazine, where we put those sorts of recipes in the column all the time. And it's not a hard thing to do. It really is not. And then when we started our conversation, I was talking about Sherry Fordham. You can make your own seitan, is the word that is the popular word. And you can season that up to taste like ham. And all it is water and flour. hour, and you get rid of the starch and you have the protein and you season the protein. So that is a processed food, but it's not a highly processed food. So you're controlling for every ingredient that goes in there. You can shred it, you can fry it, you can bake it, you can boil it, you can slice it, and you can flavor it the way that you want. And it is solid protein, which is the challenge. And I think that's why people think they have to have a meat substitute, because we've made protein a food group instead of a nutrient that it really is. So a person thinks, I have to have this meat. You don't. If you just are eating a baked potato and carrots and broccoli and a salad, you've gotten all the protein that you need for the day in that.
All right, Donna, it's always fun talking to you. Tell us where we can follow you.
You can follow me, of course, at Message Magazine. And now there's messagemagazine.com where my information is. I'm here on Facebook at Donna Green Goodman. Our business is Lifestyle Therapeutics. Or you can follow me at Still Shoutin'. That's at Still Shoutin', STILLSHOUTIN on Instagram and Twitter.
Oh, thank you as usual for joining us. What is so good is, first of all, I have to say something. My mother-in-law is an excellent cook. She can throw down. You know her.
She can work it.
And so last night she did make some of those oatmeal patties with a barbecue sauce. And it was
slapping.
You know how you talk about still shouting. I was shouting. So anyway, we are all on this journey together. And I thank you, Donna, for joining us today. If you want to hang on.
I'm going to stick around because I'm excited about your next guest. Really.
Oh, me too. And I see her in the background. She's just listening and watching. First of all, today we are honored to join Barna's Group. Or she's joining with us today. Barna Group's Senior Vice President of Research, Brooke Hempel. She manages the firm's research studies from semi-annual polls that track the pulse of Americans' beliefs and practices to custom studies for parachurch ministries, denominations, businesses, and nonprofit organizations. Through this work, Barna helps leaders gain insights into faith groups and the general population's perspectives on faith and cultural issues. Prior to joining Barna, Brooke led market research engagements for clients in the pharmaceutical, financial, and retail industries for more than 15 years. She earned her BS in business and marketing from Cornell University. Brooke is active in church planting and racial reconciliation. So I just want to say thank you, a big thank you to Brooke Hempel for joining us today. Brooke, when we were just coming on, she is like one of the most famous people that we don't know we know, because I don't know how many articles that you have read, or maybe you have been in church and you've heard your minister cite Barna. Mm-hmm. Everybody cites Barna. We are looking with great interest and anticipation to the different work that you put out. And so, Brooke, it's an honor to talk to you today. Thank you.
It's a joy to be able to do this work to equip the church. We love it. We love being able to see how God's moving in this world and what he's up to, and seeing that in our data. So it's a pleasure to be able to get to do that.
I really need to know behind the scenes, because that's where you're holding things together. You're coming together. How do you pick the studies that you're going to, how do you pick the question and the stuff that you're going to analyze?
Yeah, it's a combination. So our team, as we kind of do research, we'll notice things and we'll think, well, that's interesting. We'd love to dig into that at some point. So we kind of make a mental note. We'd love to dig into that. And so we have a bit of a wish list, in the next couple of years, we want to do a study on this. But then also we have ministries that come to us and they say, hey, we're working in this space and we're seeing these things, and we think there needs to be some good research about this. And so it comes together when we say, yeah, we've seen that too in our data. We want to understand what's happening there. And so we kind of come together with a partner and say, let's dive in, because we know how to do research, but we may not know as well how things happen on the ground, and they have more of that experiential knowledge, but they need some more 30,000 foot data to kind of see what's going on. And so it comes together because ministry partners come to us and say, hey, let's do this. And then we sometimes we'll put together a group of partners if there's something we're really eager to jump into, and we'll gather a few partners and say, let's study this. So it's a little bit of a both and, but it's very organic. It's, you know, based on things we're seeing happening around us in ministry, and we say that really needs to be dived into so we can understand better.
How do you want people to use this data when they get it?
That's a really tough thing in ministry. I think people aren't used to making decisions based on data. Mm-hmm. And I love Donna. You kind of alluded to this in her segment when she was talking about, you know, God is, he gives us the tools to go and make wise choices. He gives us research. He gives us science, right? And so it's the same. It's like, it's not crowding out the Holy Spirit by us looking at data and saying, this is what we see. It's God giving us a vision through data, right? And so we want people to look at data as a way of understanding a landscape. Here's what's going on, whether that's in the country, whether that's with a certain group of people, whether that's maybe even in your community, what's going on in our community? Let me use this data to help me be empathetic, to understand where they are and what they care about and what they need, or even just what they believe, and then meet them where they are. Right. So that's what the data gives us the power to do, because we can't go out and interview every person in the country. But, you know, we can generally get a sense of this is where people are. These are the issues that they have concerns with. These are the beliefs that they have. And we can use that to be prepared and equipped, just like the Apostle Paul would study a city before he would go into it. That's what we should do. We study our data and we say, great, before we go into that environment, let me understand a little bit about these people and how they see the world. And then I can meet them better there and I can engage with them more authentically.
Have you seen anybody use the data in this effective way? Have you seen that happen?
We have worked with some ministries that have done that well. It's a little bit more of a stretch for churches to do that. But during COVID, I think a lot of churches had to make decisions on the fly. So they got a little more familiar with what does it look like to check the data for the week and say, okay, how are people doing? Oh, shoot. You know, they were engaging online and now suddenly they're dropping off. That's important to know. We need to start looking at the data. So we got in that kind of way of making decisions during COVID. But more broadly, we've worked with some great ministries who've used some of our findings from research to then develop programs or tools to equip people. One of my favorite examples is World Vision has done a lot of research about global perspectives on faith, and they particularly wanted to understand young adults. Mm-hmm. And they knew that young adults had certain issues that they cared about. And so they wanted to know what those were and how they connected with their faith, or if that was part of the factor, right? And so they did this study with us called The Connected Generation, 25 countries. It was amazing to look at basically millennials in 25 countries and find out they were more alike than different because of this kind of technological connection that we have, right? They share bits of culture because of the technology that pulls us together. Mm-hmm. So they found through this that they were getting a better understanding of why certain issues mattered to young people, and also why there was a pervasive sense of anxiety. Yeah. And so they were noticing that because of the way people are engaging with technology and because of the way their lives were kind of just, you know, going through day to day of their lives, they weren't getting this balance of the spiritual lens to the technology, to the news they were seeing through social media and things like that, right? So they developed a whole program for high school students to go through that was experiential. It was hands-on. It allowed them to take their faith and put it into practice by learning about people in different cultures, by learning about, you know, people's vulnerabilities and how do we actually empower them and help them well? How do we see an issue in the world and not get afraid, but actually say, you know, God's got this and he has a role for me in this. And what is that? Mm-hmm. And so to turn around that sense of anxiety and turn it into resilience by leaning on God and leaning in there. And so they have this whole curriculum that's very experiential that allows students to really see the world through that Christian lens that sometimes is missing in our young people.
Missing. Well, you know what? I appreciate that, what you're saying, the depth and the breadth of the study and the analysis that you are doing and you offer all the time. It is so valuable. And we wanted to bring you on today because I noticed a couple of very interesting titles that were recently released. One in particular is on restoring relationship.
Yes.
Especially during this time. And so you talk about young people, and then you talk about, as we noted in your bio, that you are interested in racial reconciliation. So if there ever was a time in which that restoration was so important, it is now. And so I would love, you know, before I ask you about that, I want to ask you particularly about the racial aspect, because I'm seeing a lot of titles coming out of Barna that are specific to the Black church.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I wonder, and I'm looking at the data, and I'm wondering if you all think the way I think, that does this hold true for the Black church? Because I think my experience is so different. What do you think about that?
Yeah. You know, you asked earlier how we choose our studies. I have had a passion to be able to tell the story of the Black church for probably about 3 or 4 years now, because I've seen in the data and very consistently over decades that on the whole, Black Americans have a deeper faith and better engagement with their faith than the average American of any other ethnic group, right? And so we say, you kind of know that, right? But we see it in the data. So we're like, what's going on here? And we kind of know what's going on, but also let's tell that story. We want everyone to know that story, because the story is about how God has really worked through the church and through community to do something awesome. And so that's been on my heart to want to basically redo a study that we did almost 20 years ago on looking specifically at the Black church and the faith of Black Americans. And so about 2 years ago, we started doing this research, and we actually ended up doing most of it during COVID. But we wanted to dive in and understand, hey, where's the church now, right? It's gone through some transitions. We can see that in the data, that general culture has pulled some people away from church. Some people have kind of gone to other types of churches. What's happening there? What's going on in the Black church, and where is it going in the future? And so we did this deep dive, Trends in the Black Church just came out. And we looked at people's perceptions of their church and their experience there, what they love about it, what they wish was different. And then we also dove in pretty deeply on civic engagement. What does it look like for the church to be involved in civic issues? What role should people have as a Christian, or do they think that they should have as a Christian and the church should have when it comes to the broader social issues in our country? And so we pulled all that together into this really comprehensive study that I think is so important. Because is it okay if I just read something from it real quickly? There, the opening couple paragraphs to the study, I think, really tells the story. So, you know, we acknowledge we did this during the pandemic, and also there was a huge awareness of racial injustices, not only with police violence, but also with just the way the pandemic was handled and people's experiences through that. And so we said that actually was a great time to do this research, because it really highlighted the endurance and innovation of Black churches. We saw that all through the pandemic. We were surveying pastors, we were surveying churchgoers, and more than anyone, the Black church really catapulted forward in responding. So this is one paragraph from our intro. We acknowledge that, and then we said that the truth is that Black churchgoers are the bellwether of resilient U.S. Christianity. They're not immune to the broader trends of religious decline, which we do see, but Black Americans stand out as faithful, prayerful, and intimately acquainted with the Bible. We saw that in our research 25 years ago, and it's a pattern that has held steady over decades and over demographic changes. Though it's by no means monolithic, the general portrait of the Black church is that of a group of believers who are spiritually disciplined and a force for social change. And we really believe that. And we saw that in our study and our data. And it's just a moment to celebrate the incredible legacy of this church and then say, wow, look, it's actually at this moment transforming to move forward into what's new, you know, post-pandemic and having gone through all sorts of changes.
Well, it just seems like, you know, we've got such good data, yet so far apart sometimes, or feeling so far apart, especially right now during a time, you know, one of your studies gave us, or I should say, one of the conclusions was that many Black Americans, in particular African Americans, feel politically powerless.
Yes.
And then we see ourselves, unfortunately, because of that, somewhat at odds with the traditional evangelical community.
Right.
And so, you know, when we're talking restoring relationships, and I want to get to some of the other relationships and everything like this, but where is the, not common ground, but where is the space in which there is going to be some kind of meeting of the mind?
Mm-hmm. I mean, our hope with this study on the Black church was that it's for the church, that it can be used to equip her for the future. But also our secondary hope is that it can show the broader church that there's something really important that the broader church needs to learn from how faith development is happening in the Black church. It is powerful. And honestly, where that commonality is in our passion for the Lord. And I think Black church does a better job of instilling a lasting foundation of that. And the broader church has a lot to learn. And I really hope that people see that. And that it's a way to draw us together and say, you know, even theologically, there's a lot we have to learn that if you haven't grown up in a multicultural environment, you're missing things in scripture that you just don't understand because you're seeing it through your own lens, right? So we need that. We need each other to see the full picture of God. That's not an easy thing to overcome because there's a whole lot of gap. I mean, you're right. We have another study just came out called Beyond Diversity, where we just studied people's perceptions of race in the church. And there is a big gap. White Christians have a lot of learning to do and a lot of changing to do. And we really hope that this data equips them to first hold up the mirror to themselves and say, oh my goodness, yeah, there's a lot that we're missing here and we need to engage. And then second, to know how to do that in a way that is responsible and faithful as Christians. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there is a gap, and we really hope that we can continue to share data that will help call people to action, help people see that there's a need to engage differently.
This is so interesting and powerful to know that, you know, the resource is there, just like you said. Not only is the Holy Spirit there to help you, but you can read the data and look at it. So talk to us, you know, when I'm thinking about restoring relationships and I'm thinking about our upcoming family issue. And I know for years, I don't have a better word for this. Maybe you can give it, but for years, you can go to any prayer meeting at any place around the world and there's a mother there praying for her quote unquote wayward child. I don't know what's the new term for that? That sounds so old fashioned, you know, and if you talk about prodigal, that's even, you know, that's biblical. Yeah. I don't know what the right term is, but you know, today the data shows that we've got plenty of millennials, Gen Xers, Gen Zers who are finding their lives outside of the church. What is your data showing? The stressors, first of all, and then maybe what are some of the ideas about bringing people back into community?
Restoring. Yeah, well, first of all, when we looked at relationships, we did look at parenting, we looked at marriages, we even looked at singleness. What is that like? And we were looking at those factors that impact those relationships negatively, usually negatively impact those relationships. And one of the things that was kind of a maybe we knew it, but it was kind of an aha, was that some of these issues are universal. Everyone's got a relationship that needs to be restored. And so part of it was, how can the church be a help in that? Because if that relationship is not healthy, then it's leading to other things happening, right? And also on the reverse of that, when we work on our relationships, all sorts of other things come along with that, right? So we see, for example, a correlation between higher anxiety and depression, in loneliness, and even in drug abuse in places where there are broken relationships of one sort or another, right? So sometimes it's hard to know which is the chicken and the egg on that, but the point is that they go hand in hand. And so if we want to deal with the bigger questions or the bigger impact, we need to also deal with the relationships. It's really hard to restore a person to a church community or a faith community if they're surrounded by people with whom they don't have a good relationship. Like, that's one of the keys to them having stability, is that you have solid, strong relationships. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, we've noticed over the years, the number of close friendships that people have has dwindled. You know, yeah. It used to be, you know, you could cite four or five close friendships, and now it's gotten to like one or two statistically. Mm-hmm. And that's concerning. They have lots of surface level relationships, but we need those deep foundational, I can call you at any moment kind of relationships. And as a whole, as a society, we don't have those. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a really critical part to bringing those people back into the church. And we see this in some of the Black church data. There's a lot of people who said, yeah, I grew up going to church, or I'm familiar, like 9 out of 10 Black Americans has been in the Black church. Absolutely. Yeah. At one point in their life. Right.
Right.
And so how do we call them back? We call them back first with the love and knowledge of each other that comes through relationship. It's just how God calls us home. God is a relational God. And so in order for us to bring people into the church, we have to, in the same way, pursue them as a person and want to be with them and want to restore those relationships, so that also they are feeling comfortable and safe in an environment where they're surrounded by friends and family that they know.
Wow. I thought that it was the particular part in the study that I thought was interesting was where you are, I believe his last name was Cox, and he was writing about young adults and adolescents. And the question was about relational skills with our adolescents, not just for them, but as we work with them. And there were some ideas about the young people in particular, because we are seeing more and more young people who are sort of cool on faith, Christian faith. So what do you think we could be doing better based on the data for the young people?
Yeah. I mean, it is, sometimes it's even just the basic things of helping them know how to build healthy relationships. Technology is a huge barrier to that. It's a huge barrier to a deep and lasting sort of friendship, or other sort of relationship, whatever that may be, marriage, whatever relationship it is, that really it's made it hard for a whole generation to have meaningful, genuine sort of relationships. And so that's actually just training that's modeled. So much of it is modeled. A lot of the research around young people and helping them kind of maintain their faith has said that there's people outside of their family who also kind of usher them along the way towards making that faith real for them. And so making sure that they're surrounded not just by their family, but a few other people, a few other adults in their lives who they trust, who can draw them in and help them to have an understanding of what it looks like to live out your faith. Because the biggest disconnect is usually I have a kind of compartmentalization between church and faith and the rest of my life, whether that's friends or school or work or whatever it is, I've compartmentalized that. And when you do that, it's really easy to drop the church component, right? It's like, oh, well, that doesn't fit in my schedule, so I'm dropping it. But when we see that it actually is in every part of my life, then I can't just drop that. So helping them to see how their faith fits in their vocation, in the work that they do. That's the main thing that we do, you know, out of our lives. The number of hours we spend is in our work. So how does my faith fit into that? How does my faith fit into my relationships? How does it change the way I treat people and how I care about them? How does it fit into the way that I engage civically about loving my neighbor and about seeing God's image in them, right? And so the training is not just Bible teaching. It's mentoring and coaching them to say, God is in everything you do, and you need to be working towards bringing him to light in all of those places. And that will bring you joy. And that will create a sense of lasting relationship with the Lord that will keep you with him and keep you with the church.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't understand. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Donna.
I was just so inspired when you first started talking, Brooke, because you're doing the work of Jesus. And I listened to you, and then I think about when Jesus was on earth, he literally was documenting what he did. You know, when he healed somebody, he said, go show yourself to the priest, because that's where they kept the records of what was done. Mm-hmm. And then when we I think COVID has gotten us away from ritual and into relationship. And we fuss about the millennials and the Gen Xers and all of that who aren't falling in line to the ritual. But I have a millennial. And what I'm watching him do is relationship with people. Exactly what you just said. In his job, when he's socializing, when he's online, when I go out with him now, he always wants to introduce me to this collection of people. And what they say to me is, your son is so kind. And they're naming the traits of heaven, which are the gifts of the Spirit. And I think we really miss an opportunity to follow the lead of these young people who have taken religion from the church and made relationship in the community. And that's the same thing Jesus did when he was here on earth. They had all these rituals. He said, that's not what I'm about. This is what you need to be doing. And I was over here bursting as I listened to what you said, because to document it and to explain it and for these young people to literally be affirmed in it, because they're questioning us because we're not kind to one another. We don't practice what we preach. Yeah. And there's a world out there who needs to learn what we've taught them. And I think that God has shifted this stuff so that they're going about telling the world, giving the gospel to the world, the good news of Jesus Christ. Not come to this church where they're going to squelch you or not be nice to you, but you can come to my house. Right. You can hang out with my friend. You can go to the park with me where I'm teaching you the principles of heaven. And I think that heaven is really pleased with that.
Yeah, that's where the work is done. And it, the very, you know, silver linings of the cloud of COVID is that we've been forced to do that, right? Yes. We've been forced to step outside of our programs and our building and just be, which is what God really calls us to be. And we see that in restoring relationships. Those churches that do focus on that, they focus on healing, on counseling, on just emotional health. They actually have thriving millennial populations. We saw that consistently, which was really interesting. They're hitting a nerve in a generation, which I so love that you say, we have some learning to do from them. Our young people have a lot to teach us. And that's important, that this is a symbiotic relationship. You know, God's given us each other to learn from each other.
Wow. You know, I just, in my mind, I see all you all there at Barna in white lab coats. Yeah. I mean, what Donna says, okay, so this is Donna's take on what this, you know, her analysis of what these numbers mean. I'm wondering, when you all get this database back and you see the slide in participation or the difference in the way people do it, are you ever pulling your hair out and be like, oh my Lord, what is happening? How do you respond when you see a slide like that?
Yeah, we get the reputation sometimes for being bad news Barna, because oftentimes it's bad news, unfortunately. So it's true. You know, we have to constantly encourage ourselves of like, that's just what we're called to do. It's like being a prophet. You bring the bad news, and a lot of people don't want to hear it, but it needs to be said, because that's how correction happens. Mm-hmm. And so for me personally, you know, I love that our team, we get to process this together, and different people will process it differently. But for me personally, I frequently will see something in our data study that we put out, and I go, I want to get involved in something that's addressing that. So, you know, my bio says I'm involved in racial reconciliation. I'm probably in 4 or 5 different ministries that do that, because I've seen in our data, there's a problem. You know, we haven't done a good job as a church addressing racial justice issues and of really pursuing redemption in our country. And so I can't just look at that and go, okay, here's the data. I gotta respond. And so that's my call is, okay, Lord, what are you calling me to do in response to this picture that you're showing us here?
Yeah. One last word. Tell us anything else that you can tell us in like the next 30 seconds, because restoring relationships also talks a lot about singles. And so, you know, I would love a last word on both restoring relationships racially and with singles, either one. Or both, actually both.
Yeah. Yeah. So singles really need some special care. We tend to focus so much, and it's a good thing to focus on family in the church, but then that can alienate our singles. So remembering to draw them in and provide ways for them. They want to be with families too. Provide ways for them to be an important part of the community in the church. I think that's really essential. And we see that in our data. They have a lot to give. And so we want to, you know, give them space to give, but also not wear them out. We just want to love them and know them. And I would say the same thing is true in terms of, you know, our broken relationships racially. We really just need to focus on knowing each other deeply and listening well to each other deeply. And listening does not just mean hearing talk. It means empathy and understanding. And so that's really the pathway that we have seen show up in the data over and over as we've surveyed church leaders and churchgoers. It's like, if we are focused on empathy, we'll get there.
Yeah, that's Brooke Hempel, Senior Vice President for Research at Barna, that we all listen and look to and read. Brooke, would you tell us how can we follow you? How can we make sure that we see everything that comes out when you release it?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, our website, barna.com. When you first go on there, there's a pop-up to pop your email in there, and we'll send out weekly or sometimes more often notifications, an article, an excerpt from our research, or the latest release that's come out. That's the best way. We do have a Facebook and a Instagram and Twitter account. So just search for Barna, B-A-R-N-A, and we will pop up.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us and for such good information. I feel as though people are going to be enriched by this. And I encourage everybody to try to go and pick up the one on restoring relationships. There's a lot in there, particularly about the epidemic of loneliness and how we can, what we can do to restore relationships. Listen, messagemagazine.com, we're still here. God is good. He's extended our life and he has blessed us to be able to bring this kind of information, this kind of conversation to the people in and around your world, just to uplift so that we can all work on this, walk on this journey together. We're in the midst of a campaign. Please go to messagemagazine.com where you can donate, so that we can go into more prisons where you can subscribe for someone. Just last week, our Bible study writer, Rashad Burden, he got three phone calls. Well, he told me about three phone calls. I don't know if they happened last week, where people called up and said, I'm calling for my prayer. We're here to pray for you, walk alongside you in this journey. And message works. When you send it out, people are blessed because the Lord is working through his people and through his means. And message is one of the means that he is working. Messagemagazine.com, donate or subscribe. Sign up for our new preview, not our preview, but our digital edition that you can sign up online, and you can don't have to wait for the magazine, the actual magazine, to come in the mail, but you can read it online. And here's the kicker right here. Here's the sale. For right now until the beginning of August, you can get the print edition, send that to someone, and you hold on to the digital edition. You can read yourself, so you can bless somebody and bless you and your home. Don't forget to follow us and like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We appreciate you. Much love to you and yours. God bless. See you next week. Same time, different conversation.